70 years ago today marked a significant event in American history, especially for bootleggers, drinkers, and teetotalers. When Utah became the 36th state to ratify the 21st Amendment in 1933, national prohibition was officially repealed. But prohibition is a chapter in America's history that remains fascinating and a little mysterious. It was called a noble experiment, the greatest social experiment of modern times. But although beer, wine, and liquor were illegal, speakeasies flourished and bootleg booze abounded, leading Will Rogers to comment, "Prohibition is better than no liquor at all." Edward Baer is a British journalist and the author of Prohibition, 13 Years That Changed America. He says prohibition was the result of righteous beliefs in the moral imperative to improve the health and well-being of Americans, spearheaded by women who often were abused by their drunk husbands. But, he says, prohibition also reflected fear of new immigrants and their drinking habits, and fear that men who drank would be less productive on the assembly lines. Terry spoke to Baer in 1996 and asked him what the prohibition law actually said.
The prohibition law did not forbid the actual drinking of alcohol in one's home, but it forbade almost everything else, its transport, its import, its sale. You could not give a gift of a bottle of anything. It was a pretty watertight series of laws, which meant that, if you had reserves in your house, you could drink away until there was no more. But after that, you could not buy it legally, you could not sell it legally, you could not import it. Every avenue seemed to be cut off.
You write that no one counted how hard it would be to enforce the prohibition laws. And you point out, too, that people were willing to take the risk of being caught, and also that law enforcement officials were willing to be bribed to overlook the law, to turn their heads.
The prohibition era was, I would say, the most corrupt era of American politics in the history of America. Most people's memories of prohibition here probably go back. The only thing one remembers is the old television series about Elliot Ness. Well, that was just the tip of the iceberg. The corruption went up to the White House. I mean, Warren Harding, the first president of the prohibition years, 1920-24, he had liquor and vintage wines brought to the White House by customs officials who wanted to ingratiate themselves with him. The Senate Library was the most exclusive speakeasy bar in Washington. Harding himself had the little house on K Street where he had private drinking parties. Everybody broke the law. In the Senate and House of Representatives buildings, the cellars were full of liquor. The cellar space had been rented out to bootleggers so that they could walk around the Senate building and sell their liquor to senators and other officials in the building. I mean, of course, that was just the tip of the iceberg, too, because the amount of bribery was unbelievable.
See, you're arguing that prohibition created created a lot of rackets around it.
It certainly did. The bootleggers were very, very wealthy people. The saloon, the speakeasy joints were, in particularly New York, practically unhampered by police control because things were so corrupt that the police inevitably looked the other way. Of course, they were bribed. The one thing that one hasn't mentioned about prohibition was, why did a lot of people that you wouldn't expect to be prohibitionists become prohibitionists? Because among the backers of the Anti-Saloon League, you have people like John D. Rockefeller, you have Edison, you have the DuPont de Nemours family, and above all, you have Henry Ford. And the reason why all these people were prohibitionists is tied up with industrial America. This was the first time that on the assembly lines, it was very important to have skilled workers who were sober. And that's why Henry Ford, even before prohibition came into effect, had his own private police force. And he would keep a watch on all his workers. A worker caught buying liquor, even beer, was warned. And if he was caught doing it a second time, he was fired. And Henry Ford is on record as saying, if ever prohibition is repealed, I am going out of business because I don't want to have the situation that I had before prohibition when there was a lot of absenteeism because people were so drunk.
Some of the biggest bootleggers during the prohibition era went on to become very wealthy, very respectable liquor distributors or manufacturers after prohibition. You want to name some of them?
Yes. For instance, well, probably the best known figure of all was the father of President Kennedy, Joe Kennedy. Joe Kennedy had his finger in many pies. He was a very wealthy entrepreneur and businessman, Hollywood film producer, and so on. But one of the things that he did was, through, if you like, a series of dummy companies, he was a major bootlegger. Now, how big was he? Well, the proof that he was pretty big came when Prohibition came to an end, when the major liquor firms and wine companies in France and liquor firm companies in England and Scotland legitimized what had been a clandestine operation by appointing their former bootleggers as official representatives. Now, who became the official representative of Hague whiskey, of Gordon's gin? It was Joe Kennedy. Who became the representative of a series of vintage wine companies in America, a company called Alliance Distributors that was owned by the gangster Frank Costello. There was another company called Capital Wines and Spirits, which became very big after Prohibition, and this was a company that had been set up by Meyer Lansky and Lucky Luciano. So you see that what happened eventually was that the clandestine operators became, at the end of Prohibition, the official licensees doing exactly the same thing, but, of course, at much lesser risk than they had done for 13 years.
Do you wish you could taste some Prohibition alcohol, see what it was like?
Not particularly. The one's got to remember, I mean, if one's interested in the history of liquor, that the cocktail is the child of Prohibition. And the real reason for the popularity of cocktails was that it masked the sometimes terrible taste of bootlegger gin and whiskey. And so by having a cocktail, you mixed it with other things and you didn't taste the awful taste of bad liquor.
Did you have anybody during Prohibition saying, okay, you know, alcohol's illegal now, but let's face it, there's still so much alcohol that's being consumed, and rackets are flourishing around it. Something's going wrong here. Were there people speaking out about that at the time?
There were people speaking about that at the time. And the curious thing is that as Prohibition became more and more discredited, so electorally it became more important to vote in favor of Prohibition. The crunch came with the presidential election of 1928 when the Democratic candidate, Al Smith, who was a wet, as they said in those days. In other words, he wanted to get rid of Prohibition, which, of course, Roosevelt did in 1933. He almost became the Democratic presidential candidate, but the forces, Anti-Saloon League and others, were such that he was finally beaten to the post by a nonentity who, of course, never won the presidency. And there are hundreds of cases of senators, congressmen, being caught with, after holidays in Cuba, coming back with barrels of rum and being arrested, some of them, partly because they couldn't do otherwise because the barrels were broken and there was a smell of rum in their luggage, being convicted, fined, sometimes going to jail, and then being reelected in a prohibitionist state. So you had this incredible, the irony on it is that there was an incredible amount of hypocrisy.
Prohibition was repealed in 1933 under FDR. You say one of the reasons why was the Depression. How did the Depression affect Prohibition?
The Depression affected Prohibition in several ways. First of all, things became so tough with ordinary people in America that they couldn't afford the huge prices that bootlegger whiskey and gin commanded in those days. So you had the ironic fact that it just wasn't as profitable as it had been in the earlier days of Prohibition. The second thing was that the movement to repeal Prohibition came from the same people who had at one point been ardent prohibitionists. For instance, if you take the DuPont family, huge chemical works and so on, putting a lot of money into the Anti-Saloon League, they became very prominent after Depression set in because they felt, rightly or wrongly, that America was denying itself badly needed tax money, which they would have got if liquor had been legal. And they felt also individual taxes rose and commercial taxes rose after the Depression. They felt that if Prohibition came to an end, then the tax situation would be much better for them. And it was not, I think, a sort of moral decision. It was a very sort of self-serving attitude. But of course, they were right.
You said that the farmers also had financial reasons why they wanted Prohibition repealed.
The farmers had, in the pre-Prohibition days, sold a lot of their corn to the distillers. And, of course, in the early days of Prohibition, before the depression of the great market crack, 29, and the miserable years of 30, 31, the farmers had done pretty well. They started doing miserably once the depression set in, and they, too, belatedly realized that the market that they were missing.
Did you find out about how drinking habits changed after the repeal of Prohibition? Did America go on this big drinking spree?
Curiously not. All the accounts are that the return to legalized drinking happened without an enormous upturn in crime, excessive drinking. It re-entered the mainstream of society, but without all the consequences that the prohibitionists had warned about.
Edward Baer, speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. Baer is the author of Prohibition, 13 Years That Changed America.